Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Well, the Bruce Ivins story, Mr. Anthrax Killer, is getting weirder and weirder. Barack Obama may announce a vice presidential candidate today. Odds are it'll be tomorrow. Interestingly, tomorrow he's traveling through Virginia. Does that mean Mr. Kane? I don't know. We'll see. A lot to talk about. Also, how come Jerome Corsi's book is in the New York Times bestseller? Beyond the issue of the bulk buys, how does this work? We've got a lot to get into today, a lot in the news. I want to start out first, though. This is an issue that even a Republican, Gordon Smith, our senator here from Oregon, says this is a sad commentary on our health care system, medical tourism, the outsourcing of medicine. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Or is this simply the way things are? Renee Marie Stefano is with us. She's the chief operating officer and general counsel for the Medical Tourism Association and editor of the medical tourism magazine, medicaltourismassociation.com is their website. Renee Marie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The situation with medical outsourcing, the outsourcing of medical tourism is really pretty startling. Senator Smith's numbers, he says, for example, heart valve surgery in the United States, $115,000. In Chennai, India, it's $7,000, a $108,000 difference. Tell me how this is evolving as an industry and as a trend.
Well, what you're starting to see is this is becoming a trend in the U.S. Medical tourism has really been going on for decades overseas, people traveling from one country to another for various reasons, whether it's access, accessibility or access to better health care, whether it's an issue of cost or oftentimes what you're seeing people travel for is just more high technology care.
Well, for the very wealthy, the United States has been a medical tourism destination for a long, long time. I mean, the Shah of Iran came here. There's no shortage of despots, dictators, and heads of state who've come here to get health care, you know, for things like cancers and whatnot.
Absolutely. The numbers have decreased, though. If you speak to most of the large hospitals, the branded hospitals that people came here for, they will tell you that their numbers have been down, and a lot of that has to do with the difficulty in obtaining visas. So you're starting to see those same people that used to come to the U.S. traveling to countries like Singapore or Thailand or even in Latin America for their care instead.
The organized labor I don't know of any specific organized labor campaigns against this. But a lot of people in the labor movement are speaking out against this, that this is really just another form of outsourcing. This is no different than Mattel making toys in China instead of the United States, that U.S. jobs are at risk, and that there may even be a national security aspect to this, that you know, just like what if we lose our ability to make our own food? We've already lost our ability to make most of our own electronics. We can't make a cruise missile right now without chips literally from China, the only country in the last decade that has threatened us with a nuclear weapon. And what happens if we reach the point where we really don't have a healthcare infrastructure that is solid because we've outsourced so much of our healthcare? I mean, this is and to what extent is this the further are we witnessing the further deterioration of the American middle class, in as much as those middle class jobs of everything from the top end doctor down to the bottom end, orderlies in the hospital, are vanishing?
frankly, you know, we don't look at it that way. And most people, I mean, if they knew about medical tourism and the people that are going for medical tourism, they wouldn't be saying that. That's sort of our, you know, typical U.S. protectionist point of view, where we're seeing this as we're outsourcing and people are going to lose jobs. The fact of the matter is 50 million people in the U.S. do not have health insurance. And that is the largest group of people that are traveling overseas for care.
Right.
And
isn't that in and of itself, though, an indictment of our system?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've got a serious problem. There's too many disparities for us to be able to make that up. I mean, we've got, for instance, a ball and socket for a hip replacement here in the U.S. would be $9,000, and that same part, same manufacturer, would sell it for $2,000 in India. When you have price disparities that we do not try to repair, we're going to continue to have this problem. But most of the patients that are traveling overseas for care, it's not taking food off the tables of our doctors. These patients would not be getting the care here. So nobody's losing jobs.
So if somebody's uninsured and they need heart surgery, if they didn't go to overseas where they could get this for $9,000 and stayed here in the United States where it's $115,000, which they can't afford, they'd just simply die.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That seems to me like this should be, I mean, we should be ringing alarm bells about this. As much as there, you know, it may be a fine thing to go, you know, to Thailand to get a tummy tuck, you know, and spend a few $1,000s less and have a nice vacation at the same time. When we're talking about life and death issues and the failure of our healthcare system, to be able to provide for life and death necessities in the United States, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the Declaration of Independence, you know, it seems like we're not a very pro-life country right now.
I would agree with you. We've got a lot of serious issues that need to be resolved, and unfortunately, we're not seeing any, you know, too many solutions to that problem.
To what extent, Renee Maurice, we're talking with Renee Maurice Stefano, the CEO and General Counsel for the Medical Tourism Association and editor of the Medical Tourism Magazine. We saw when the Medicare Part D was being put together in Congress, we saw the big insurance companies, the AARP, which is actually just a big insurance company or a front for one, we saw the pharmaceutical industries drop, I think it was $350, $400 million, some mind-boggling amount of money into lobbying Congress, and then Billy Towson walked away with a $2 million a year job as head of pharma as a result of this, to make sure that the federal government, that Medicare could not negotiate prices, had to pay retail in all cases, even though they're the largest, if they were able to buy it wholesale, they would be the largest wholesale purchaser in the United States, right in front of the Veterans Administration, which does buy it wholesale, oddly enough. So there was this big industrial lobbying effort to prevent a real solution and keep a real problem in our system because it was very profitable to the health insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies. To what extent is your industry, the Medical Tourism Association and the medical tourism industry, lobbying to maintain our system as it is in order to increase your own revenues?
Right now, we're actually talking about what we are going to have to do in terms of lobbying. We have not been doing any lobbying. Fortunately, there have not been any major oppositions to this development of medical tourism. Recently, the AMA released some guidelines with respect to medical tourism and indicated that they would be seeking legislation. So obviously, now that's changed. As far as insurance companies are concerned, insurance companies and pharmaceuticals, which are, you know, two of the largest lobbying groups, pharmaceutical companies are concerned because of the, you know, the opportunity for pharmaceutical tourism, people going and getting their drugs overseas cheaper.
Right.
And insurance companies are taking the opportunity to actually look at medical tourism and incorporating medical tourism into their fully insured and self-funded plans. So they're actually looking at this as an opportunity to provide creative solutions, reduce their costs, and I don't see them doing any lobbying anytime soon. But we're at that point where the insurance companies are sort of standing on the edge of the lake. We don't know where they're going to go. Some of them are starting to send people, and others are just sort of waiting. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, well, you know, from an insurance company point of view, if your mandate is to make money, and your mandate is to, you know, then, and you can get a heart surgery done in India for $9,000 that would cost $100,000 in the United States. I understand some insurance companies are even paying for a spouse or a you know, somebody else to go along with a person. They're paying travel expenses, they're paying lodging, all these kinds of things.
You're absolutely right. And they're also incentivizing by waiving deductibles and copays as well.
Right. Now, and again, this brings up the issue of how much damage is this going to do to an already dysfunctional healthcare system here in the United States?
Well, the fact is, I mean, the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies and medical equipment companies, each year, they are the only aspect of healthcare that continues to make high revenues.
Right.
So at some point, something needs to give. Somebody has to make a little bit less. And if, you know, if the government is unable to provide a healthcare system, as, you know, some of them are suggesting, well, then we're going to have to take some of the stress off the existing system. And medical tourism does provide that opportunity to take a little bit of the stress off.
I just, you know, we did our show from Denmark a couple of months ago, and nobody from Denmark is leaving the country for healthcare, you know, because you can walk into any doctor, any hospital, any office, anywhere, and it's free. I mean, you just walk in and say, you know, this is what I need. Okay, no problem.
And it's great quality, too.
Yes, it is. It's very high quality. And we just need the same thing in the United States. Renee Marie Stefano, the CEO and General Counsel for the American Tourism, the Medical Tourism Association, editor of Medical Tourism Magazine. MedicalTourismAssociation.com is the website for more information. A complex subject. Renee Marie, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Out in Taiwan, my gallbladder out in Greece. Took a side trip up to Sweden to fill some caverns in my teeth. Saw a doctor down in Denmark and a specialist in Spain to see what could be causing me this dull but steady pain. Took a trip up to Toronto just to buy some little pills. Thought I'd died and gone to heaven when they handed me the bill. Went to Norway when I noticed that my eardrum had a hole. Got back home just in time to watch the Super Bowl. It's been a brutal year, but man, I'm glad I was overseas, where you can see the doctor when you really got a need. Where people, they live longer, babies also like they should. I guess they call it healthcare, and I guess they got it good.
I guess they call it healthcare. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, here in the United States, we have such a dysfunctional system. You know, during the break, Sean said to me, well, Tom, you know, if you were sick and would you go overseas for surgery if it was cheap and you weren't insured? You know, fortunately, I have health insurance. But if I was uninsured, or for that matter, if my health insurance company said, hey, you know, if you'll get this done in Thailand, we'll pay for the trip. We'll pay for your wife to go. We'll put you up in a 5-star hotel for a week, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't know, I'd consider it. And that's the problem. I mean, it's just like, If something is only available in your community at Walmart, are you going to shop at Walmart? Or Amazon.com, the Walmart on the web. I mean, it's the question shouldn't be, are we going to have medical tourism or not? The question should be, how do we fix our broken healthcare system? Medical tourism being a symptom of how badly broken it is. You know, our guest was talking about the pharmaceutical companies concerned about pharmaceutical tourism. When I lived in Montpelier, Vermont, every Saturday, it might have been every Sunday, the bus would load up downtown and people would get mostly elderly folks would get, not entirely, actually a lot of, you know, a whole variety of people, but mostly people over 50 isn't elderly, obviously, but, you know, mostly people over 50 in any case, people who tend to use more pharmaceuticals. And particularly the more expensive, you know, fancy, the statins and the blood pressure drugs and the, you know, stuff like that. Get on the bus and drive up to Montreal and buy their pharmaceuticals. And it was Bernie Sanders who organized the thing back, what, 6, 8 years ago, 10 years ago? And it's probably still going on. So, I mean, this should be a symptom of a system that is broken, period. And we need to address. We need to start considering the frames of things rather than just the things themselves. For example, I found it really interesting that when Pastor Rick asked the question, Rick Warren asked the question of both John McCain and Barack Obama, at what point does a baby have human rights? That nobody challenged the frame. Because the question had embedded within it an assumption, which is that anything that is involved in a pregnancy is a baby. And, you know, there's fertilization, and then there's implantation, and there's 3 days between the two. So you've got a fertilized egg floating around in the fallopian tubes that has not yet implanted. The body doesn't know that it's pregnant yet. The body doesn't start producing hormones until that implantation occurs. And then it becomes a zygote, as I recall. I don't remember all the lists, but there's like a half a dozen different names of the stages of this thing goes through before, after a few weeks, it becomes a fetus. So perhaps the appropriate answer from Barack Obama should have been when it becomes a baby. And now we as a society have to figure out when is that. The Supreme Court says that's when it's viable. Or at least, you know, the basis of Roe v. Wade is that viability, if it can live outside the mother, independent of the mother, it's a baby and it's protected, highly protected. If not, then it's somewhat protected. But in any case, there was that frame. And the frame on healthcare should be, you know, how badly broken is our system? The frame on John McCain. I found this fascinating. There's the democraticstrategist.org, the Democratic Strategist strategy memo. And they talk about how what Karl Rove always does is he does a very subtle and very complex personality assassination. And the way for the Democrats to fight back is to do the same thing with John McCain, only do it with truth. John McCain says this election is about character, and he's right. In the 2000 presidential race, the Bush campaign, led by Karl Rove, viciously attacked John McCain's wife and child. They said his wife was a drug addict and that the child he and his wife adopted from an orphanage was actually his illegitimate black daughter. On election night, his wife was in tears. Back then, McCain was disgusted. He said there was a special place in hell for rumor mongers like these people. He made a promise to his family and to his supporters that he would never run a dirty campaign like that. Never. But early this year, John McCain hired Charlie Condon, the very same man who was behind those vicious smears, to run his South Carolina campaign. And then several weeks ago, he brought Stephen Schmidt, leading protege of Karl Rove and master of the political hit job, on board to be his campaign manager and write the talking points for a new negative campaign against Barack Obama. It's sad to watch McCain's willingness to humiliate himself by hiring the same gang of people who horribly insulted him and his family. It shows that he's become so desperate to win this election that he's willing to sacrifice his principles and his personal honor in order to do it. That's the frame that should be wrapped around John McCain. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Call him now at 866-303-2270.
Support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman program, 34 minutes past the hour.
Their feet were black and shiny, their eyes were burning red. Had no meat or feathers, these chickens were dead. They picked the farmer up and he died by the claw. They cooked them extra crispy and ate them with coleslaw.
Well, it's our pigeon alert. Or our ghost chickens alert, as the case may be. Here's where it gets strange. There's in Doha, They're having a pigeon epidemic. They're having a real problem with the increasing number of pigeons in Doha has posed a problem in some places of the city. No car, parked car is safe. No one is immune from the attack of these defecation machines. Feces can be seen on floors, stairs, and verandas of commercial buildings and residences. I'm telling you, it is not actually pigeon poop. It is actually some sort of micro transmitters. These are cleverly disguised. Now, why Doha? Why are these robots in the planet Xenu placing all over Doha their little electronic, maybe they work like the RFID, microscopic RFID chips, you know, they pick up whatever's said and kind of transmit it off. Why? Well, turns out that the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, the chief of the World Bank, has called to restart the Doha negotiations, maybe in Doha. And then also this from the Peninsula, the newspaper out of Hong Kong, the Peninsula, Qatar. Practically unimaginable not too long ago, Doha is now actually emerging as a party destination. In 5 years, things keep going as they are, it should rival Dubai as the place to be. So the rich, the powerful, the famous, the powerful, really. The place where the spies from the planet Xenu want to know what's going on.
And ate them with their claws.
Our pigeon alert for the day. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Dave from Nebraska. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. So glad you broached the subject on the medical tourism. I am in that situation.
Really? I think it really is meta to the much larger issue of the disaster of our healthcare system. Is that your case?
Exactly. I retired early, and when shopping for insurance, and of course the insurance agent tells you doesn't tell you what's not insured in the policy you take up, and I am underinsured. And it turns out I need a couple new hips and probably some spinal operations also.
Mm-hmm.
And it would force me into bankruptcy if I did it in this country.
Wow, because of the deductibles, even though you're insured.
Yes. Well, the policy I have slightly just covers some of the doctor's expenses, but none of the hospital.
Right. So are you going overseas?
I believe so. I've been trying. I've been procrastinating because I'm not real anxious to do that.
Yeah.
But you know that Harvard Medical School and Johns Hopkins are firmly invested in India and teaching hospitals.
Yeah, and some of the for-profit hospitals in the United States are actually building branches in other countries.
Yeah, I believe that's the case.
I mean, here we have the outsourcing of medical care. Dave, thanks for sharing that with us. And good luck.
Yeah, thanks.
Good luck. I wish you well. Brian in Freehold, New Jersey. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Funny that he was just talking about hip replacement. So your guest said something that really is my core question on this whole thing, that the same hip socket replacement made by the same manufacturer, sold by the same company, is sold to India for $1,000 and to us for $9,000. Now, I understand we have a high rate, you know, malpractice insurance and stuff, but I think
that's got nothing to do with it.
As you continue to discuss with her, though, the lobbying money is ridiculous. I think we're paying in our premiums and in all these services, we're paying for their lobbying as well, which I never even had thought of.
Well, we're paying what the market will bear is the bottom line. I mean, what they have in the United States is a captive audience. The other countries that have national healthcare systems, I mean, there are countries that are poor where they simply have to sell things for whatever the market will bear, and the market won't bear very much, and so the prices are low. But then you look at countries like Denmark or Canada or the United Kingdom or France, or, I mean, you know, pick any of the developed countries in the world, Japan, and in those countries, because you've got the buying power of the entire government organized together, and the government says, you know, give us your lowest price. I mean, it's just the government's just doing like the same thing Walmart does with their dealers. They're saying, you're going to sell to us at the lowest price, or we're not going to buy it from you. And so, you know, there's nobody in the United States saying that, basically. And
now, are we not saying that because of there being lobbied not to say it? I mean, does that go back to that?
Well, no, it's because there's a relatively small monopoly. We have monopoly capitalism in the United States. We don't have laissez-faire capitalism. We don't have really any real form of capitalism. It's monopoly capitalism. You've got a handful of big drug companies. You've got a handful of big, prosthetics. I don't know what the word is for all the physical devices, the hips and things like that, manufacturers.
Right.
You've got a handful of companies that own the majority of the hospitals in the United States, for-profit companies. This is how Bill Frist's daddy became a billionaire. And you've got a handful of companies that basically run the health insurance industry. And many of them have interlocking boards of directors, and they're all just skimming everything they can off the top. And who's paying the bill? The middle class of America. Directly or indirectly. Either through, you know, having our paychecks be reduced because, so that our employers can provide health care. And they don't come out and say, hey, you know, we're taking this amount out of your paycheck. Although in some cases you do. I mean, you actually pay a portion of the health insurance premium. In other cases, they simply say, hey, you know, we could normally pay you X, but now we can pay you 10% less than X because 10% is going to the health insurance. It is a sick and twisted system that works to the tremendous benefit of a small number of very, very wealthy individuals and corporations. The rich in America don't give a damn. They can write it out of pocket change, and they, by and large, control the media, and the middle class in America gets screwed. And it is absolutely a crime. Brian, thanks for the call. And Michael in Albuquerque. Hey, Michael.
Oh, Tom, this is Mike. Hey. I'm just curious. I buy my medication from Canada. My pharmacist sends the prescription up to Canada, and he buys the medication from Texas, and then I get my pills from Canada.
And right, so the stuff is made in Texas. They sell it to Canada, where the government negotiates prices, so there's low prices for pharmaceuticals because they do bulk buying. And
low prices. I save the amount of money I save pays for half my house payment every month.
Wow. So they manufacture it in Texas. They ship it up to Canada. The Canadian pharmacy then ships it back to you in Albuquerque, New Mexico. This is so bizarre.
Yes.
This is so
now,
bizarre.
Now, my question to you, Tom, is... is this legal for me to buy my medication from Canada?
There was a time early on when the Republicans were trying to stop people from doing that, and the drug companies were trying to stop people from doing that, and they really tightened the screws now, and the border services under the guise of, you know, well, people are buying things like oxycodone, you know, from Canada, and, you know, Rush Limbaugh is getting his supply from Canada, so we've got to stop that. Illegally or whatever. But I, you know, frankly, I don't know the state of the art right now. I don't know, or the state of the law right now. I don't know, Michael. So I'm assuming that it must
be. I do understand that the pharmacy up in Canada, when they send me my medication down to Albuquerque, they have to mail it regular mail, insured. Otherwise, if it's first day mail or something like that, it's inspected and it can be confiscated.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know how it works. I was just curious if it was legal or not.
Yeah. I'll look into that, Michael, and we'll get back with you on it.
Okay, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. It's amazing. Kevin in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hi, Tom. My name is Kevin, and last year this time I was working in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, you know, the Midwestern state, our nation's Rust Belt, the so-called...
where I grew up.
Yeah, the so-called socialist sector of America. And believe you me, how this right wing... works. Trust me. You know, United Healthcare is based out in Minnesota. And basically, I was fired from a job because I mentioned socialized medicine.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Wow.
At a dinner table. After work.
Not good.
Okay, and you really need to be aware of how deep the right wing is flowing through those states. You know, it's no mistake why the Republican convention is going to be held in Minneapolis.
Because of United Healthcare being there? This is the company that paid its CEO, Bill McGuire, the $1.78 billion?
Yeah.
Yeah. And is the major insurance company, when you buy your insurance through AARP, that's typically who it goes through.
You know, the so-called socialist belt of America.
Why do you call it the socialist belt, Kevin?
Because Minnesota is known for its socialism. Wisconsin.
You mean like the Democratic Labor Party? Is that?
Excuse me?
The Democratic Labor Party? I mean, these were places that were hotbeds of progressive activity, particularly in the 1880s.
Anymore.
Yeah, but everything is becoming right wing now. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Michigan, and Louise's dad was the assistant attorney general for the state, and the attorney general's position was elected position Frank Kelly, and he was the attorney general for like 15, 20 years, I mean, a long time, a Democrat. You know, the Democrats had a lot of power in Michigan, for a long, long time, and they were by and large, pretty much progressive Democrats to a large extent. Now it's just incredible to me the Republican influence in that state.
Well, you know what it is, though, and I'm sorry to bring this up, but it's basically racism. You know, Minnesota was socialist as long as the only two people of color was Prince and Kirby Puckett.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more people of color moving into those states now.
It could be, Kevin. I think that that's more effect than cause, though. What it is that the Republicans use race as a tool in elections.
Exactly.
But, yeah. Thanks a lot, Kevin. 45 minutes past the hour.
Air America makes history. Live broadcasts and continuing coverage from the DNC in Denver on Air America and AirAmerica.com. Our time is now.
Listen in to a radio station with a mighty host of heaven sing. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
If you want to feel those good vibrations coming from the joy that is love can bring.
Welcome back to the True People's Radio. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Marilyn in Los Angeles listening on K-Talk. Hey, Marilyn.
Hi, Tom. God, I don't know what I'd do without you every morning.
Well, thank you.
I have a friend whose niece has psychiatric issues, and if you think the physical medical part of it is bad, this girl, she's, you know, like I think in her late 20s, she needs to be hospitalized. They cannot get her into a hospital. There's a doctor in the family. They have money. They have insurance. There are virtually no beds for psychiatric patients anymore.
Right.
Unless you are suicidal or homicidal, you can't get into one.
And the primary reason why is because mental health issues like that, severe things like, profound schizophrenia, paranoid schizophrenia, things like that, tend to be lifelong conditions or long-term conditions and thus are very expensive for the health insurance companies.
Well, this girl, young woman, is tortured, and she knows she needs help, and she's looking for help, and she tries to get herself into a hospital, and they won't admit her. And they ended up putting her in UCLA finally because of pulling strings and pulling other strings with doctors trying to do favors. And still they couldn't get her a bed because they don't have the beds. So she was in emergency. And what it would be like to already be having such problems and then to be in that chaotic environment.
Yeah.
And she tried to get out of there finally. She was calling her mother who's in another state and saying, please, help me get out of here.
Yeah.
And they ended up putting her in restraints. Can you imagine what that would be like?
It's a terrible thing. Marilyn, thank you for bringing it up. And this is one of there are a number of people out there. Ted Kennedy was one of the best advocating for parity between mental health and physical health. Anytime that we talk about health, we should be talking about both. And I absolutely agree. And thank you very much, Marilyn, for that. Charles in Brooktondale, New York. Hey, Charles.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I went to Thailand for surgery on my knee and for a complete medical checkup and for dental work and new glasses, and I was treated like a prince over there.
Hmm. So you had a great experience.
Yeah.
Did your health insurance company pay for it?
I don't have health insurance. Well, thing is, like, my wife and I used to have health insurance about 3 years ago. It was costing us $18,000 a year.
Right.
And we're both pretty much retired, don't have much of an income. So we had to let it go. There's a firm in town. I can mention it to you, but it's a guy here in Ithaca and a guy in Bangkok, and well, they arranged everything.
Hmm. Yeah, I know this is an industry now. I mean, the woman that we had, Stefano, she's the CEO of the Medical Tourism Association, complete with a trade publication. Interesting, Charles. Thanks for your story. Thanks for sharing that with us. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, and excuse me, Sean in Indianapolis. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Sean. There's a couple of things. You know, I'm very well versed in this.
And you've had something like 200 surgeries, have you not, Sean?
236.
236.
Yeah, and I'm finding out now I've got incurable squamous cell cancer because I soaked in betadine as a kid, and I live in a state where we have a adoptive governor in the 70s, and I can't sue anybody over it.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, Sean.
The more I go into the hospital now, though, the more that I see nurses that we're bringing over from other countries, not only are we paying them less, but we're taking good nurses out of countries that need them, and the American nurses aren't getting hired.
Right.
And it's just a mess. And
yeah.
Not only are there no psychiatric beds, that's not my problem, but there's no American, there's no regular healthcare, physical beds either. That's why I think just giving people healthcare insurance isn't going to do it. Who's going to hire the nurse? We got a nursing
shortage.
We got a doctor shortage. We got a bed shortage.
Yeah, we need to fundamentally reform our system from the bottom up. I mean, we need to tear this thing apart and put it back together from scratch. Sean, I'm so sorry to hear about your cancer diagnosis. I wish you the very best, and you'll be in my prayers and thoughts. And thank you for the call today.
Okay, hey, Tom, one more other thing, too. These superbugs that are in these facilities.
Yeah, you got one once, didn't you?
That is causing more money than... know anything, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Although that's a problem all over the world. I mean, MERS is a big problem in the UK system as well. Sean, I got to move along. Thank you for the call.
And
thanks for listening. And man, good luck. It's a tough one. Gary in Indiana. Hey, Gary. Got a minute here before we got to wrap up the hour. Your last thoughts here.
Okay, Tom. I just wanted to get a truth fix from you.
Hmm.
I've been hearing, and there was a caller to the Ed Schultz show yesterday, who alleged that the story that John McCain told about the soldier who drew the cross on the ground was lifted, with maybe some adaptation, from an Alexander Solzhenitsyn book, possibly The Gulag Archipelago.
Yeah, we talked about that at some length yesterday. Yes, it was, and 5 years ago, McCain started telling that story, only he started telling it about another soldier. And just in this last year, he has... First of all, it was not in his biography, in his autobiography. It wasn't in any of his early stories. And then 5 years ago or so, he picked it up and started telling it about another soldier. And it was virtually verbatim. It was right after Solzhenitsyn, an article about Solzhenitsyn had been published in which that story was told in one of the magazines. I forget the name of the magazine. And then in the last year, McCain has now changed this story to a story about himself. And I think this could be... I mean, talk about Al Gore being brought down because he said he invented the Internet, when in fact Al Gore did sponsor the legislation that created the Internet, and he never said he invented it. But, I mean, talk about somebody being brought down by an exaggeration. This could be a big one. It really could be a big one. But the media seems to be ignoring it.
This is Tom Hartman. Listening to Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Nuclear power. I got John McCain running around the country saying, let's build more nukes. Barack Obama even saying, well, you know, if we can work out some of the problems, it's something we ought to consider. I think this is downright... dangerous. Yes, I hear the buzz too, and I don't know what to do about it. Seems to be on our end. So, anyhow, Dan Gaynor is with us. He is the vice president of the Business and Media Institute. Businessandmedia.org is the website. Dan, welcome to the show.
It's good to be back. I don't hear the buzzing, so you're right. It's on your end.
Yeah, good. So it must be internal to our studio. That's reassuring because it's awful loud.
It's the government. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, there you go. It's Alberto Gonzalez. He's got a bug in my... Actually, it would be...
Yeah, somewhere else. Yes, yeah. We can't discuss the radio.
There you go. So, Dan, you're out there pitching for nuclear energy.
Well, I'm out there pitching for energy. Because we discussed wind power a couple times ago when I was on. I am about as neutral on energy type as possible. And I think really as a nation, we need to be. Mm-hmm. We have an energy based economy. The Chinese know this. They're building coal plants. While we're sitting here talking, they probably built another coal plant. They understand that we have energy needs. But, you look at our national energy picture. We get 50% from coal, 20% from nuclear, 20% from natural gas. There's a lot of room, I think, for us to get all sorts of types of energy. So nuclear, I think nuclear is a great idea. It works for France. They get 80% of their energy, electrical energy, from nuclear power, and they haven't had any problem with it.
Well, they've had a lot of problems with it. They've got towns that are renaming their own regions because they don't want people to know that they've got a nuclear power plant in their backyard. You've got a lot of people involved in French agriculture who are freaked out about it. There's a lot of opposition to nuclear power in France. It's just that it's not being promoted by the nuclear power industry. They also haven't figured out what to do with their own nuclear waste. If Egypt 3,000 years ago had developed nuclear power, they would have gotten their 30 years worth of cheap electricity, and we would still be guarding pyramids filled with radioactive waste for another 10,000 years. Tell me that's not a problem.
Well, I'm not saying it's not a problem, but it's not a problem that should eliminate nuclear power. One of the things that they've been doing is going through the previous waste and then reprocessing it again. Cuts down on the waste. You get more energy.
But it becomes, at a certain point, that can't be done. You end up with non-fissionable, but yet still highly radioactive elements. And it doesn't take that many reprocessings for that to happen. And then you've got all this nuclear waste. I mean, it's just this, and this is something that we are bequeathing. This is once again the selfishness of this current generation of this last 50 years or so, that we're willing to create poisons. 1 ounce of plutonium, if properly distributed, is enough to kill every human on Earth. We're creating poisons that will last for 250,000 years, and we don't give a damn about that as long as we get cheap electricity.
I think people do care about it. That's why why there's been an endless battle over the Yucca Mountain facility. People do care that we take care of this. But at the same time, if we don't have enough energy, and we're running into this problem literally maybe even next year or the year after, Maryland, where I live, we're talking about 2011, we're talking about power outages because we don't have enough power, because we have not built enough power. Nation Power Grid only added 13 gigawatts of electricity last year.
You want to increase 10% of all the electricity in the United States? Just pass a law that says it's illegal to have parasitic devices plugged into your wall. In other words, no more of those transformers plugged into the wall. You've got to have the power supply inside the device with an on-off switch.
But people won't do it.
You make industry do it. Industry doesn't do it because the Underwriter Laboratory standards say that if it's less than 50 watts, it doesn't have to be certified, and as long as the power supply is. And so they make and certify these external power supplies rather than the device itself. That should be changed. I mean, that's a really simple thing, and it would eliminate the need for a couple of power plants nationwide if we simply did that. There are so many things that we could do. And on top of that, tell me that without Price Anderson, without you and me, through our tax dollars, insuring all the entire nuclear industry in the United States, because no insurance company will come near it, tell me that without Price Anderson, we could even have a nuclear industry in the United States. We can't.
Well, I mean, certainly we're insuring, but we're also getting the benefit of it. And we're getting, 20% of our power comes from nuclear power, and the whole push, this is one of the great ironies, I think, of the power debate. Everybody is pushing for us to go toward hybrid cars. Forgets that they don't like any of the forms of energy that they use in the electrical grid to generate the electricity.
Hybrid cars don't leave behind radioactive waste.
But they plug into the electrical grid and get their power from the electrical grid, which is 50% coal, 20% nuclear, 20% natural gas. They don't like any of those. So unless we're going to turn out the switches and sit in the dark, we need energy.
Yeah, and of course we need energy, and so let's get energy out of the ground. Let's get geothermal. You know, Iceland is completely independent of foreign oil because they're able to supply all their energy needs with geothermal.
But they're also a dinky little country that, you know, doesn't have anywhere near the needs of even a major metropolitan area in the United States.
There are huge chunks of the United States where we're close enough. I mean, here in the Pacific Northwest, all the way down the, you know, California, there's a lot in the Yellowstone. There's a lot of places where there's a lot of geothermal energy relatively close to the surface that could be tapped. There's wave energy that could be tapped. There's wind power. Denmark gets 19% of its electricity from wind power. Norway's getting 70% of its power from water power. I mean, hydropower. We're here in Portland. We've got the Columbia River, you know, big dams, all kinds of power coming from the Columbia. There's all kinds of other sources of electricity.
Why
should we poison our children and grandchildren just so that we can selfishly have cheap electricity now?
I think we should pursue all the ones you just listed, but then we run into problems with several of those where the environmental movement doesn't like it. Environmentalists oppose wind power. I mean, Ted Kennedy, the guy who was battling wind power off the coast of Nantucket because he didn't like it messing with his view. In my own state, again, in Maryland,
that's ancient history, Dan. That's ancient history, and you're not finding the environmental movement out there opposing wind power.
The Democratic governor of Maryland just a couple months ago prevented wind power from being built on state lands. So,
well, that's wrong.
I
think that's wrong.
Okay.
You know, it's just very simple. I mean, let's just lay it out. I think that's wrong.
Right.
And if the alternative, I mean, first of all, I think the number one alternative is energy savings. We can save mind-boggling amounts of electricity in the United States. And secondly, by some just, you know, fairly straightforward things. And secondly, instead of producing radioactive waste that 100 generations from now will still be having to deal with, let's move to, I mean, you know, wind power is competitive with nuclear power. Actually, it's, you know, a nuclear power plant doesn't produce its first watt of actual electricity from nuclear power until it's about 10, 12 years old.
Well, the problem with wind
held
power
in Caldecott, it's 18 years because of all the oil that goes into its construction, $18 million into $1 billion into constructing the one, all the oil that goes into mining the uranium, all the oil that goes into refining the uranium, all the oil that goes into transporting the uranium, all the, you know,
that goes into all the things you do for wind power as well. The problem with wind power, there are corridors that are wonderful for wind power. Fantastic. Texas, you know, the Midwest, along the coast, but that's not everywhere. You can't just...
Right, everywhere else there's solar power. Look at Germany has less sunlight than we have in the Pacific Northwest, and we're famous for it raining here all the time. Germany has less sunlight than that, and yet they're producing an enormous... They have solarized so much of the country that they have not had to build two new nuclear power plants in the last decade. They're shutting down their nukes in Germany.
See, where we're agreeing, and it's nice to actually agree on some things for a change, where we're agreeing is, well, I mean, I think we should pursue all these. My concern is we're at a difficult spot in the power grid right now. Media don't cover this very much, but we're at a spot in the power grid where we are closer to the edge than we've been in a long time.
But Dan, in 2005, we gave $13 billion of federal money. You're in my taxpayers' dollars. This doesn't include Price Anderson. This doesn't include the protections in the event of a disaster. We just gave $13 billion to the nuclear industry. There was another $20.5 billion in the 2007 energy bill. In fact, industry CEOs in the nuclear industry say that without 100% subsidization, they can't build a new nuclear reactor. This is not a rational technology.
Well, if we were to get rid of any subsidy, anything for anybody, you know what we'd have? We'd have almost 100% coal, because coal is cheap. Coal is also opposed massively by the environment.
Even coal is subsidized we're paying the externality. We're paying to deal with the cleanup and the waste produced by the mining of it.
Coal costs massively less than all the other forms of energy.
Well, I would submit to you that if we are not at it, we will shortly be at the point where solar and wind are going to be even less expensive than coal, particularly when you consider the environmental costs.
Well,
we're paying for all the cancers that coal causes. Coal industry isn't paying for that.
I look forward to the day when we have lots more energy because we have an energy-based economy.
Yeah, and energies that are renewable and recyclable, in hopes. Dan Gaynor, Vice President of the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org. Dan, thanks for dropping by.
You're welcome. Pleasure.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at hartmanradio.com.
and it burns, burns, burns. The ring of fire, the ring of fire. And it burns, burns, burns.
Well, this is something that this is going to be very interesting to watch. Welcome back to the program, by the way. Tom Hartman here. A new report. This is a Sasha Fall report. This is a commentary by a commentator who. Let's just leave it at that. That this is commentary. It may or may not represent what is actually going on. Okay, but here's the new reports circulating in the Kremlin today, are stating that Prime Minister Putin and President Medvedev have jointly ordered Russia's strategic missile troops to begin the encirclement of the United States with a nuclear noose in preparation for all-out war with American military forces. I noticed gold went up $30 this morning. I wonder if there's some relation between the two of these. Sparking the fears of Russian leaders, these reports states, were conversations held this past week between Putin and former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, where Mr. Kissinger stated that the likelihood of Senator John McCain ascending to the presidency of the United States was, quote, all but assured, end quote. Russian policy analysts have long considered a McCain-led U.S. government as a continuation of Bush's foreign policy for an American-led implementation of a new world order that would see the abolishment of the United States and the establishment of world trading blocs in which Putin has vowed to prevent occurring. Excuse me, of nation states. And then it goes on to talk about, you know, this Randy Shuneman, McCain's top foreign policy advisor, being paid by Georgia. Further enraging Russian leaders, U.S. and Canada are jointly cooperating in an attempt to wrest vital Arctic resources. We're trying to claim the oil in the Arctic, which is going to be ice-free within the next 5 years, maybe shorter than that. And so what are they doing? Well, Putin announced in July that he was increasing Russia's nuclear aircraft carrier and submarine fleets, and beginning to work with other nations to form a strategic alliance against the United States. There are also reports that Russian military forces moved into Georgia SS-21 missile launchers, and that Russia plans the deployment of Iskander SS-26 surface missiles in Syria and the Baltic enclave of Kaliningrad. I've been in Kaliningrad. In fact, I worked in Kaliningrad. It's their main port out of which their nuclear submarines operate. Venezuela's President Chavez, in fact, I wrote a chapter about it in my book, The Prophet's Way. Venezuela's President Chavez has further announced that he has accepted President Medvedev's offer to send a naval fleet to his South American. We'll see. And Poland, you know, saying that they'll take our missiles. It's like the warmongers on both sides are just having a fine old time. I mean, that's what I would boil it down to. The right wing in the United States as well. This is something that just needs to be said. I just want to lay this out here. Corsi's book, for example, Jerome Corsi, it's in the top of the New York Times bestseller list. What, not because people are walking into bookstores and buying it, but because there's a network of right wing funders who keep alive right wing websites and book clubs and magazines and think tanks. And they all buy these books in bulk to give away on their websites because they're getting these million, $2 million, $3 million, sometimes $5, $10 million a year grants from multiple right-wing foundations and very, very wealthy individuals. This, by and large, is not happening on the left. Now, why would that be the case? Why is it that right-wing authors end up at the top of the New York Times bestseller list because of these bulk buys and left-wing authors don't? The reason is really simple. The right is about concentrating wealth and power in a small number of hands. And so those small number of hands who are concentrating the wealth and power will give that wealth and power to their willing spokespeople, to their front men, to their shills, who will get out there and promote their message. On the left is about good government. It's about having a government that works. It's about having not-for-profit hospitals. It's about having a not-for-profit healthcare system. It's about having not-for-profit schools that actually... So, and the reason why not-for-profit? Because if profit is your first motive, you don't deliver a good product. If your first motive, if the reason why you're in business, if the reason why you're doing what you're doing is to deliver healthcare, if that's your first goal, then you're going to deliver healthcare. If your first goal is to deliver education, you're going to deliver education. If your first goal is to deliver a profit, then you're going to cut corners and you're going to deliver a profit first and then some health care secondly. So you know, all these rich guys are putting all this money into the right wing. But on the left, because it's simply because it's a good business investment. If they toss 10, 20, 50, $100 million into subsidizing right-wing talk shows and talk show hosts, into subsidizing right-wing websites, into subsidizing right-wing authors, that let's say it's 100, let's say, my guess is, frankly, it's more like $400 or $500 million a year. But and when you include the think tanks, the Heritage Foundation and Cato and all these other things, couple hundred million, you invest a couple hundred million dollars, what do you get back? Billions. Billions of dollars. For example, the Lieberman-Warner climate change bill of 2007, which thankfully was filibustered oddly by the Republicans, would have given $500 billion in taxpayer subsidies to the nuclear industry. So you get all these right-wing fringe people whose books hit the New York Times bestseller list, Coulter, Corsi, Savage, D'Souza, Horowitz, because they're funded. But on the left, nobody's making money off good government. Nobody's making money off a country that works. Nobody's making money off a longer lifespan for people or well-educated children. And so nobody has an incentive to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in the advocates for it. That's a fundamental problem in America. We got to figure out how to deal with it. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Maybe. Maybe John Maloney is. He's the mayor of Mount Isa in northwestern Queensland, Australia. Put out a call for unattractive women to move to town. That was his phrase. He said, the town is a place where ugly ducklings can flourish into beautiful swans, and called on the beauty disadvantaged to flock there. A little blowback. Some of the local folks saying the mayor was returning us to the dark ages and making the guys that live in this town seem like sex-hungry, starved men that will pounce upon the first girl that they see walking down the street. It ain't quite working out the way the mayor had hoped. Apparently there is a lot of single men in town. Anyhow, I just want to finish that rant. How do we, this is a serious question that we're going to have to come to terms with. The progressives, the liberal movement in the United States, liberals by and large are about good government. This is, why would Bush, for example, destroy FEMA? Why? So that he can privatize it. He'll have an excuse to privatize it. He brings in a horse champion lawyer, you know, a horse displaying, competing, whatever lawyer, and says, yeah, let's put this guy in charge of FEMA. He'll screw it up badly. And he did. So that then they can say, now we got to have Blackwater patrolling the town. So it's government is an opportunity to take taxpayers' dollars and put them in the hands of for-profit corporations. That's the conservative worldview. The liberal worldview is government should do its job. The problem with that is nobody's making any money. Because nobody's making any money, nobody has the money to buy think tanks. Nobody has the money to buy politicians. Nobody has the money to buy media. Nobody has the money to go say to, for example, a radio station that's carrying progressive programming, well, why don't we get together a group of businessmen, who would be Republicans, of course, and just, you know, buy the programming on this station. Let's just do that. You know, we don't need progressive programming on the stinking airwaves. After all, there's an election coming. I mean, how do you deal with that in America? How do we deal with the disproportionate power that corporations and wealth have in the United States when that power... This is what Thomas Jefferson wrote about. Thomas Jefferson, in arguing to strike down the laws on primogeniture, which was the law. Jefferson inherited, when his father died, when he was 16 years old, he inherited his mother, he inherited his brothers and sisters, he inherited the slaves, he inherited the entire estate. And one of his first legislative efforts when he became a member of the House of Burgesses in Virginia was to offer legislation that would end primogeniture. It was ended in the United States by 1790. And Jefferson said that the reason why this had to be ended, and there had to be equal distribution among all members of the family, not just the direct children was to prevent a landed gentry from emerging in the United States, to prevent there being what Jefferson referred to as wealth so concentrated that it could threaten a free state. That's a quote from Jefferson. You'll find it in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? He was very clear about this. There were no truly profoundly wealthy people after the American Revolution. In fact, the first person worth $1 million in today's money, which ain't that much money in today's money, was in the 1790s, in either 91 or 97, long after the Revolutionary War. And we really didn't see the emergence of dynastic families in the United States until after the Civil War. You can't name any dynasties that started between the founding, Hancock has an insurance company, but it's got nothing to do with John Hancock. He did not leave a fortune. None of the founders did. It began with the railroad companies, the railroad barons, the robber barons in the 1870s and 1880s, and it has gone in a straight line since then. How do we deal with that? The solutions that I know of are the solutions that we have tried to use in the past. The 1881, the Sherman Antitrust Act, prevent monopolies. The game of monopoly was marketed in the 1920s to educate people about how monopolies work, how destructive monopolistic business can be, because Teddy Roosevelt had been railing on this thing. It was a word that people understood. People don't understand it now. They don't understand that we have a media monopoly, we have a pharmaceutical monopoly, we have a hospital monopoly, we have right across the board. And what these monopolies do is they serve to fix prices high, drive wages low, destroy the middle class, and prevent innovation and competition. And as a result, other countries are eating our lunch, and these big companies are growing fat and happy, and it's not good for the country. It's not good for America. What do we do about it? I think we need to start enforcing the Sherman Act, breaking these companies up like Jimmy Carter did with AT&T. An action, by the way, that was initiated before the Carter administration. I believe it was initiated by Nixon. Let's break up some of these big companies right across the board, regardless of industry. And then let's look seriously at how to get the money out of Washington, D.C. There are fewer than 100 federally registered lobbyists when Jimmy Carter was president. There's over 40,000 now. You've got industries spending hundreds of millions of dollars a year on lobbying. 40 years ago, it would have been nothing. It would have been absolutely nothing. Dave in Dallas, Texas, listening on KMNY. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey. I just called to say something in response to your guest a minute ago. You know this, I know, and you just don't always have time to say it. Often somebody points out that electric cars or plug-in hybrids require that fossil fuels be burned to make the electricity to charge them.
Mm-hmm.
That's true, but the fact we need to emphasize is that there are enormous economies of scale at work in big power plants. Car engines average 20-something percent efficiency. Large natural gas turbines manage something on the order of 70% when you take all the efficiencies into account.
Right, including
or more than three times as much as many joules output per unit fuel burned as small automotive engines.
Excellent point, Dave. By the way, give us a
shout-out.
Even
coal-fired plants are three times better.
Yeah.
And per unit carbon dioxide. But then then you said we were headed for World War III, and I got kind of distracted by that. But
yeah, that's scary stuff, I'm telling you. And this is the military-industrial. Give us a quick plug and shout-out for the station there in Dallas.
I'm sorry, didn't hear you.
You're listening on our station in Dallas.
Yeah, actually, I'm working at the station.
Yeah,
well,
Give us a quick shout-out and a plug for them, would you? Our newest affiliate, 50,000 watts there in Dallas.
Yeah, we've got 6 million people who can hear us were they to tune their radio to us, and you're the best show we have, Tom.
Well, thank you, Dave, and we're really pleased to be on the air there. It's KMNY, right?
Right.
Great.
We call it Rational Radio.
Rational Radio in Dallas, Texas. 50,000 watts of Rational Radio. Tell your friends if you're listening in Dallas, Texas. And if you're not, if you live anywhere in the country and you know anybody in Dallas, Texas, send them an email. What's the frequency, Dave?
1360 AM. I didn't call for the plug.
No, I know you didn't, but I wanted to get the word out. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along. So 1360 in Dallas. Let everybody know. Nancy in Long Beach. Hey, Nancy, what's up?
Coal. That was probably 20 minutes ago. I grew up in West Virginia. I haven't lived there for 50 years, but I'm, fourth generation. Coal was very much part of my life growing up because the town I lived in was surrounded by small coal mining towns, and on the radio at night you could hear who was supposed to report for the cat eye shift and things like that. I just read a book called Coal River, nonfiction, relatively new within the past year, and it's about the clear cutting, cutting off the tops of the mountains. Beautiful,
right.
Western.
It's called mountain topping, actually.
Yes. Yeah. And they just go in and take the whole thing off, and it is a more efficient way to remove coal. Unfortunately, it leaves a very ugly landscape, and the things that seep down into the streams are not good for the fishies and other things.
Right.
The company mainly behind it is Massey Energy, and that's a guy named Don Blankenship. The offices of Massey are just across the West Virginia-Virginia border, but Coal River is just a fascinating book,
and it
just makes you cringe.
Okay, Nancy, thank you very much for that. And this is a classic example of how when a company's goal is to make a profit and not to do something good in the world, but purely to make a profit, their first mission has to be to internalize profits and externalize expenses. And the expense of burning coal, I would submit to you that the major expense of burning coal in the United States is autism. Look at all the mercury that we have in our food supply here now. It may be associated with the vaccines, but it's looking increasingly like it's the synergy. It's the vaccines with Tamiflu, with mercury in them, are hitting kids who are already sensitized by the fact that their body's already loaded with mercury. And where does that mercury come from? Burning coal. Autism, asthma, cancers, acid rain, the destruction of, I mean, here, these are expenses that run into the hundreds of millions or perhaps billions of dollars. And the coal companies are paying not one penny of it. You and I are paying all of it. That's the externalization of expense and the internalization of profit. And it's wrong. It's just plain old wrong. Frank in Detroit. Hey, Frank, got a minute before the break. What's up?
Nothing, Tom. I was just wondering if you can tell me, why is it that the Democrats are so afraid to take off the gloves and go after these Republicans when there's so many issues they could get McCain on, you know, such as him leaving his crippled wife to marry Cindy, his constant flip-flopping on issues.
Two quick things, Frank. No, I agree with you on all those. Two quick things. Number one, if you're going to hit really hard, you want to hit in the 6 weeks before the election. So it may be that the thing to do is to wait until just before the election to do it. And number two is that the campaign itself, the candidate himself, Barack Obama, is not going to run that kind of campaign. He said he's not going to run that kind of campaign. I think McCain running that kind of campaign right now is tainting him, and it's causing the press to start to view him with a jaundiced eye in many Americans. What Barack Obama needs to do is have a vice president who knows how to take names and kick ass. And in my opinion, that would be either Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden. And my guess is he's going to pick Joe Biden. But I think Hillary Clinton would also be a very, very good one. But please, please, not Evan Bayh, not Tim Kaine, not one of these milquetoast guys, because it needs to be a surrogate who can fight.
An historic time for America. Live, on-site coverage of the Democratic National Convention on Air America and AirAmerica.com. Our time is now.
Talk Ready News Service, talkreadynews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, how are you doing? Not a whole lot happening, but enough to certainly make life interesting.
I have a question. Can we discuss Bob Ney for a moment?
Yes.
Because I've got, you know, a lot of my listeners are sending me notes going, Ellen Ratner, Bob Ney, what's the deal here? And I can't respond to all the emails I get because I would have no time,
First of all, he can come on the air with me tomorrow. How's that?
That would be great. That would be great.
But a lot of people are saying Ellen Radner, Republican with Bob Ney.
Right.
My first and then I had somebody else say, how could you put a convicted felon on?
Yeah, well.
Yeah. First of all, G. Gordon Liddy is my first response. But secondly, he has been a friend of mine for 12 years. He was there's a fairly liberal host by the name of Howard Monroe, who was in his district, which is how we got to be close friends. Thirdly, I believe that you stick by your friends even if they do something wrong. Fourthly, he was a drunk as a skunk, but he was set up.
Yeah. Yeah, I got it that he was set up. And the conspiracy theory that I've heard is that he was set up because he was the only member of the House of Representatives who spoke Farsi. He actually was probably the only member of the House of Representatives who really and truly understood Iran and Iranian culture, Farsi, the language that they speak in Iran. And when the Bush administration started going gung-ho on Iran being part of the axis of evil, Bob Ney started pushing back, and all of a sudden he's got a federal prosecutor crawling up his butt.
That's exactly right. And I think that, look, he took those chips. There is no question about it. But I said to him, and I don't know how much of this he's willing to discuss on air, I said, Bob, didn't you think there's anything a little weird by it? All of a sudden you go to this place and, I mean, I understand you were drunk as a skunk, but didn't you see anything? He said, well, I did think it's kind of strange that one of Bush's top fundraisers was sitting next to me. I said, you could have been drunk as anything. You should have been able to see through that one.
Right. So what happened that he did that he was convicted of, Ellen?
He was basically convicted of two things. One, which, I mean, he cannot say he didn't do something because, you know, he signed his whatever and his perjury and all that kind of stuff. My view is that one thing he did do and one thing he didn't do. The first thing they got him for was signing a false travel document. Well, you know, that happens all the time. Your chief of staff does it. They put it under your nose. You sign it. So, yes, he probably signed a false travel document. But
probably every member of Congress, if a federal prosecutor dug deep enough, could find something on that level to prosecute any member of Congress for.
Right. And the second thing he did was after, I believe, one of the trips to where he was negotiating with the Iranians or whatever, he went to London. And he went to this gambling place, and people gave him a bunch of chips. And he didn't pay for the chips, and he didn't declare all of his quote-unquote winnings for who, and they claimed it was a bribe. But the fact is, bribe for what? Because they can't connect that to anything. All they can do is say that he took chips and he didn't pay for them and he didn't declare them on his income tax.
Wow.
He absolutely did that, no question.
So he was set up. That's funny. I remember when Scott Berg and I were writing this book on the history of the religion of the Nazis, Scott was the trade representative to Qatar. And we had dinner. In fact, it was the week of the First Gulf War, and we had dinner at the home of the Omani ambassador in Vienna, and there were the ambassadors from three other Middle Eastern countries there. I don't recall all the names exactly, so I'm not going to say them. And afterwards, and this was dinner in like this mansion, you know, that was the embassy or the ambassadorial residence, and gold plates, you know, with Filipino servers, and it was bizarre. And afterwards, we went to a casino. And one of the sheikhs gave to me and also gave to Scott $10,000 in chips and said, your job is to lose this faster than I lose mine. And we sat at the crap table at the roulette wheel, and my job was to lose $10,000 as fast as I could. Which I did. I lost all of it, you know, which it's just to make him look good. But it was fun. You know, it was interesting being in the casino and all that kind of thing. But, you know, I can see. But you know, Bob Ney, he's a member of Congress. He's sitting next to Bush's biggest fundraiser. Somebody says, here, have some chips, have a good time. That I would think, the circumstances are quite different. I would think that would set off some alarm bells.
Well, yeah, I mean, and clearly he shouldn't have done it, and he knows he shouldn't have done it. And that's not the, you know, at this point, obviously that my view is that he was put up with it. I mean, why would Bush's fundraiser be in London at the same place he is?
Right, on his way back from Iran. So
I don't know if he was back from Iran. I think he was meeting with the Iranians somewhere
right,
in some other
right.
country.
Right, but the bottom line is Bob Ney was trying to prevent war with Iran, and he was trying to prevent the demonization of Iran, and he speaks Farsi, and he knows Iranian culture, and he's the only member of Congress who can make that claim, and therefore
and
the Republicans
Farsi,
are condemned.
And Farsi, who wrote that whole book about Iranian and Israeli and United States relations, was his live-in, what's it called, exchange student when he was married, and he had kids, and so the exchange student was there with the kids and all that kind of stuff. And that's how he originally met Trita Parsi. And he had an Iranian roommate, I guess, in college, which is how he learned Farsi.
Yeah. So this is a guy who's very, very wired in with Iran, and so the Bush administration decided they had to take him out, and they did.
Absolutely. And the guys that, I mean, someday, it's a longer story, and I hope Bob writes a book, but some of the people that did a whole lot worse and whatever have gotten off the hook because, you know, the FBI, they got their congressman.
I think he's the Republican Don Siegelman. I mean, you know, the Republicans don't care what your party is. If you cross them, they'll take you down.
And, you know, and my favorite story is one time he showed up with his wife and his daughter at the White House Christmas party, and they said only one person can get in. So the next day he took the Bush administration's, like, four parking spaces from them on the Hill. It's been war ever since.
It's been war ever since between him and the Bushes since the Christmas party. That's interesting. That's interesting. Ellen Ratter of the Talk Radio News. I'll cover the news for our listeners here, Ellen. Thanks a lot for the call. I'm sorry we're out of time. But it was a good conversation, and good on you for sticking with Bob Ney. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
TalkRadioNews.com. Coming up next, Mark Crispin Miller. Stick around. This is going to be fascinating.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Is Tom Hartman.
How are the Republicans going to steal the 2008 election? It's pretty clear that in 2004, the systems, even if you set aside the possibility that any electronic voting machines were flipped anywhere, that in Florida they simply said to 70, 80, 90,000 African Americans, sorry, you can't vote. And in Ohio, they said, if you're voting while black, you're going to have to wait in line 14 hours. If you're voting while white, 15 minutes. Among other things. I mean, that's just the surface stuff. But let's peel the layer back and go a layer deeper here. Mark Crispin Miller is with us, a dear friend, a brilliant author. His most recent book, Loser Take All. And Mark, hey, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Tom. It's nice to hear your voice again.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. MarkCrispinMiller.blogspot.com, by the way, the website. Tell us about these Republican whistleblowers who are coming forward.
Yeah. As you noted, you and I have been talking about this issue for years now.
Yeah.
The good news is that there is an unimpeachable whistleblower out there now. The reason why most folks haven't heard his name is, of course, that the press tends to, turn a deaf ear. Right?
Yeah, there's a corporate media blackout on this, and B, no Democrat will talk about it because they're so tail between their legs terrified that anybody might talk about election fraud. They believe this Bob Trump story, apparently, that if the American people thought that the voting machines weren't safe, that they wouldn't come out and vote, and therefore they wouldn't vote for Democrats.
Yeah, which is demonstrably false because there was a lot of press about the iffiness of the voting machines before the 2006 election,
right.
And we had the highest turnout in an off-year race since, 1970.
So right, and you had a hell of a lot of people saying, give me the paper ballot, please.
That's exactly right.
Thanks.
So I don't really think any party that calls itself Democratic should keep people in the dark.
Yeah.
Well, here's some daylight for everyone. There is an amazing whistleblower out there named Stephen Spoonamore, which is exactly the way it sounds, Spoonamore.
Right. He's a lifelong Republican.
Lifelong Republican, an erstwhile member of the McCain campaign until he discovered so much about the Republicans' election fraud that he resigned, and a prominent expert on computer crime. Now, 2 years ago, Tom, this guy gave a long interview to one of the major news networks. I should say one of the network, one of the news divisions of one of the three major networks. Hmm. It's up online. You know, people can get it at my blog.
Yeah, markcrispinmiller.blogspot.com.
That's right. It's stunning. But let me move beyond that and just tell people what this guy has to say. This guy has come out and said, and he has documentary evidence to prove this, and he's talked to all the principals, and the long and short of it is that the Bush team has been stealing elections since and including 2000. Spoonamore has named Karl Rove's IT guy. Karl Rove has basically
had... This is Michael Connell, right?
Mike Connell, right, a fervent Catholic and fanatical pro-lifer who told Spoon that he has helped the Republicans to steal elections to save the babies. I'm not making this up. Whenever Karl Rove wanted something done, he would say to Connell, just make it happen. And this kind of thing has included Florida in 2000, Ohio in 2004, also, Don Siegelman's stolen re-election in Alabama in 2002. Evidence suggests he was involved in the theft of Max Cleland's re-election in Georgia in 2002. Yeah. The long and short of it is that that Spoonamore knows this guy, and it gets even hairier because it turns out that after having helped Saxby Chambliss beat Max Cleland in Georgia in 2002. One of the first
things, flipping the machines.
By flipping the machines, right. One of the first things that Chambliss did was give Connell's company, which is called GovTech Solutions, the contract to run his own congressional website. Now, if people go to the website for GovTech Solutions, they'll now find a long list of the congressional websites that Connell's company has been running. What I'm telling you is that Connell has been operating behind the congressional firewall. He operates the computer websites for the House Judiciary Committee, Senate Intelligence Committee. What we're noting here is, you know, a fervent partisan now operating with impunity and able to help Rove and others basically read every word that the Democrats send each other by email and so on. Also, Spoonamore has a record of the moment when Connell asked him how to destroy White House emails. This thing is enormous, okay? Spoonamore's revelations are driving an extremely important RICO lawsuit that's coming out of Ohio, and it's managed
by... Organized Crime and Racketeering Act, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They have named the defendants include not only the Republican National Committee and the White House, but the Chamber of Commerce, which it turns out has been operating as a kind of stealth pack for years, hundreds of millions of dollars channeled into front organizations to help the Republicans, quote, win, unquote, elections. Also, Big Tobacco is involved. Now, people can actually go to a special, a dedicated website run by Velvet Revolution, which is the nonprofit that's sort of in charge of this whole thing. It's rovecybergate.com, okay? Rovecybergate, all one word, .com. Here's the thing, Tom. What the people doing the lawsuit want to have happen is basically to depose all the perpetrators of election fraud over the last several years, most notably Karl Rove, but also Mike Connell, also Jack Abramoff, also Bob Ney, the author of the Help America Vote Act bill, who just recently got out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
who will be on this show tomorrow? What would you like me to ask him?
I would like you to ask him what he knows about systematic efforts to steal elections and see what he says.
Okay.
Because if Velvet Revolution and the lawyers can move forward with these depositions... And this is a civil case, Tom. So as we know from the Paula Jones episode, you can't really weasel out of a civil case, a civil deposition very
easily.
This
is how they nailed Bill Clinton.
That's exactly right. Yeah. We got to get these people under oath on the record, answering questions. Spoonamore is there, a Republican, an erstwhile McCain supporter, a computer fraud expert. He is there to tell the world that the Bush regime has indeed been subverting the American election system since 2000, okay?
So we now have, actually, I thought that the first time that there was a significant deviation, a well-documented significant deviation from exit polls and pre-polls and the electronic machine results was when George Bush Sr. was running in a primary in New Hampshire back in whatever year that was. 80-something.
Yeah, well, that was actually that makes a certain amount of sense. That would be 88, right?
As I recall, yeah, right, was the very first time that there was a real significant deviation.
That's right. And funny you should mention that, Tom, because as it happens, Mike Connell was discovered by George Bush Sr. George Bush Sr. is the one who discovered Mike Connell. And
Karl Rove used to work for George Bush Sr. as well.
Exactly. Actually, the infection starts with him. And let me add that in New Hampshire, John Sununu, you know, the elder, that is Bush's pal and the governor of New Hampshire at the time that Bush Sr. won his primary, he's been heavily into computers for a long, long time. You know, this extends all the way up to the recent primary in New Hampshire where they use the same machines and where Obama actually won. You know, see, in New Hampshire, 16% of the vote is hand-counted. Mm. Most people don't know, because the press has not reported, that Obama won the hand-counted vote in New Hampshire in the recent primary by 6 points. Hillary Clinton won the optical scan-counted vote by some 5 points. There is no doubt in my mind that the Republicans gamed that primary on her behalf because at that point they wanted very much to run against her, and then thereafter continued to game a number of races through the machines in order to exacerbate the divide within the Democratic Party.
Yeah, Texas in particular. I'd say when you look at the difference between the general election and the caucuses. Well, Mark, we're out of time. We got to wrap it up. But this is all right online: velvetrevolution.us, rovecybergate.com, markcrispinmiller.blogspot.com. Check it out. Mark, thanks so much for the great work you're doing.
Thank you, Tom. Talk to you soon.
And everybody, check out Mark's book, Loser Take All. 16 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Did my ballot go? Lost my faith in the government when they changed the rules without my consent. Don't wanna be nobody's experiment. Just wanna know where my ballot went. They lost my vote. I made my choice. Does anybody care to hear my voice? They lost my vote. Was that the plan? Nobody knows that I took a stand.
21 minutes past the hour. We've got to stop this. We've got to do something about this. Mark Crispin, C-R-I-S-P-I-N, Miller, markcrispinmiller.blogspot.com. I noticed that the velvetrevolution.us website has crashed since we did that segment just a few minutes ago. Hopefully it's because they got a lot of folks going over trying to look at it, and not because Karl Rove's IT guy just hacked it, but write it down, velvetrevolution.us or Rove Cyber. Oh, now I've hang on just a second here. Rove Cybergate, rovecybergate.com. Write them down. And of course, you can see it at markcrispinmiller.blogspot.com, a site which I don't believe has crashed. It is being reported by Reuters out of Singapore that a large bank in the United States is going to collapse along with several mid-sized ones. This former IMF chief economist, Kenneth Rogoff, the International Monetary Fund's former chief economist, he says the worst of the global financial crisis is yet to come. He says the U.S. is not out of the woods. I think the financial crisis is at the halfway point, perhaps. I would even go further to say the worst is to come. He said this to a financial conference yesterday. He said, we're not just going to see mid-sized banks go under in the next few months. We're going to see a whopper. We're going to see a big one. One of the big investment banks or big banks. This guy is a former professor of economics at Harvard. And from 2001 to 2004, the first 3 years of the Bush administration, was the chief economist for the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. Meanwhile, Howard Fineman is saying he's got inside information, MSNBC and Newsweek's Howard Fineman, that it's going to be Joe Biden. He says, barring a big surprise or last-minute change of heart, the choice is likely to be Senator Joe Biden of Delaware, the chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee. Meanwhile, the New York Times has been forced to run its fourth correction of one of Bill Kristol's columns. Ever since back in January when they put this neocon whack job, this guy who was one of the huge early advocates of let's attack Iraq, and now is a big advocate of let's attack Iran. He's never seen a war he doesn't love. Bill Kristol, four times now. This last time they revised it, he was attacking Barack Obama. And his facts were wrong, and so they revised the online version because the in-print version was already out. But they never noted it. They never even said, usually when they correct things, they put it in their corrections area. No, they didn't do it. They just changed the website. Isn't that sweet? And meanwhile, over at Fox News, John McCain has claimed credit for the GI Bill. You know, this new GI Bill that was passed that gives Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, you know, college education, tuition payments, 100% tuition payments to anybody who served more than 36 months of active duty, 80% of those who served more than 24 months. McCain's proposal was that you have to serve 12 years before you become eligible. But the way it was passed was 36 months, 3 years. This is the way the Democrats proposed it. McCain opposed it. McCain opposed the GI Bill of Rights. Straight through, from the beginning right on through, McCain was totally opposed to this thing, and yet he has, A, been claiming credit for it, and B, the folks over at Fox News have been willingly lying about this. I mean, just going right along with the program. This is Carl Cameron over at Fox News.
Senate, there was a measure sponsored by Democrat Jim Webb of Virginia. John McCain initially took some opposition to it because, in McCain's view, it didn't proportionately give GI benefits to servicemen and women, depending on how long they were actually in active duty and service. He thought it should be a more proportional award. He fought for it. It was inserted into the legislation. In the end, McCain supported it, and the McCain campaign argues on every veterans issue, Edie. Senator McCain has always voted for benefits, notwithstanding his opposition to some of the Democratic alternatives along the way.
All right, Carl.
Well, lie on every point. Just, you know, very simply. This is a lie on every point. McCain, yes, the one thing he said is true is that McCain wanted to amend the bill. He wanted to make it that you gotta be in the military 12 years before you get free tuition. Which is like, gee, yeah, getting in the military is a great way to go to college. I mean, after 12 years, you're basically saying, I'm going to make a career in the military. In other words, nobody's going to take advantage of it. This is absolutely incredible. It's just the chutzpah of the McCain campaign and of Fox News in lying about these things. And the fact of the matter is, and the tragic fact of the matter is, they're going to get away with it. They really and truly will, because the media is not going to call them on this. Meanwhile, remember my rant in the last segment of the last hour about how the right has all this money and they're buying these books to drive them up to the top of the New York Times list? Five authors have now sued Regnery Publishing. This is one of the big conservative publishing houses. They published Unfit for Command and other books. Five guys are suing them. Why? Because they say, and this is quoting one of their lawyers, they've structured their business essentially as a scam and are defrauding their writers because they are selling their books at, below, or only marginally above their own cost of publication. And the downside for the authors, they're not making any royalties. They want their share of the pie.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann. Call in now at 866-303-2270.
Song that when I was in junior high school, we were not allowed to dance to.
it was not allowed to be played.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number if you'd like to drop into our live chat room. TomHartmann.com. Just click live chat up at the top. We've covered an awful lot of territory today. Increasingly, it's looking like this might be Joe Biden, but, you know, who knows? I mean, the Obama campaign has done a very good job of keeping this close to the vest. I went over to BarackObama.com, plugged in my email address. They're going to make their announcement by email before they do anything else. Of course, all the news media have, I'm sure, registered there, too, so it'll hit the news media within seconds of the time it hits everybody else, but you can check it out. 1-866-303-2270. Gila. Is it Gila? Am I pronouncing it right? In Miami, Florida?
It's Gila.
Gila. I'm sorry.
Yes. First of all, I want to thank you for everything you do, and you are absolutely one of the smartest men I've ever heard, definitely the smartest on radio. I wanted to ask you, I was only 4 years old when the 1964 campaign was running, but what do you think the effect would be if the Obama people or their surrogates would take, let's say, the fear card away from the Republicans and run something similar to the Daisy ad?
I think it might work quite well. And the interesting thing about the Daisy ad, and for those people who don't know what we're talking about, the Lyndon Johnson campaign ran once. That ad only appeared once on network television.
Yeah, I've heard
one,
that.
One 60-second spot appeared once. And it's a little girl sitting there, you know, pulling the petals off a daisy. And as she's pulling them, she's counting, and then her voice kind of morphs into, you hear the voice of, in the background, you know, through the, with all the echo and everything of the guy doing the countdown. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then behind her goes off this nuclear bomb, and this giant mushroom cloud goes up, and it was, as I recall, it was all in black and white. And it was a horrifying commercial. And it didn't even mention Barry Goldwater's name, but, you know, everybody got the message. Barry Goldwater was a warmonger, and this is the nuclear era. And that would be the way, Gila, I think that you have nailed it. That would be the way to push back on the apparent setup that Randy Shuneman, the guy, you know, McCain's chief foreign policy advisor, took $800,000 from Georgia. And Karl Rove, who was meeting with Mikhail Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, just 3 weeks before they invaded South Ossetia, and then Russia, you know, reacted and overreacted, in the opinion of many. I share that opinion. This has turned, as McCain last night on TV was crowing about, he was like, you know, some of us remember, I predicted that Russia was the, you know, this is, and basically what he's saying is, you know, Obama's so new, he doesn't know anything about dealing with the Russians. He doesn't know anything about dealing with the Cold War. And I think that a Daisy ad would do it. I think it would absolutely do it. And it would have to be run by a 527. It couldn't be run by the campaign. But, hey, folks at MoveOn, Gila, thank you very much. Folks at MoveOn.org, if you're listening, this is an idea. It's really an idea. Anna in Greeley, Colorado, you're concerned about Joe Biden?
Well, yeah, I was just amazed to hear, I heard part of that speech on Amy Goodman's program about the thing that Obama said to the preacher. He didn't like his preacher who was truthful, but he likes this preacher who's a more, is warped. Okay, anyway. anyway, he was talking to him, and the preacher asked, which one of the Supreme Court justices do you not like? Mm-hmm. And he said Clarence Thomas.
Right.
And now the Joe Biden thing comes up, and mm-hmm. I say, ooh, twisted.
Well, because Joe Biden voted for Clarence Thomas?
That's right. In fact, it was his committee that pushed Clarence Thomas into the Supreme Court.
Well, it was wasn't it the Judiciary Committee that made the recommendation?
He was on the Judiciary Committee.
Right, although he was
not the
chairman.
Yeah, it just amazes me how twisted things are now.
I frankly don't know whether he voted in committee or on the floor for Clarence Thomas or not. I'm willing to take your word for it, but I'll tell you, there's no perfect candidate out there. There just absolutely is no perfect candidate. And Joe Biden is a guy, and Anna, thank you for raising the issue. Joe Biden is a guy who really and truly understands foreign policy. I have sat and talked with Joe Biden. I've heard him give a speech sitting 10 feet away from him. He's a hell of a public speaker. He is, and in person, this guy is brilliant. He is absolutely freaking brilliant. And I think I strongly opposed his vote on bankruptcy. If he was in favor of Clarence Thomas, I think that was a mistake. You're not going to find any senator who hasn't made mistakes. It comes with the territory. So I would go for it. Robert in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Tom, I'm calling concerning the American Energy Alliance,
mm-hmm.
527.
Right.
Have you heard of them?
Yeah, it's a front group for big coal, isn't it?
Well, I have no idea. I called the local KABQ 1350 AM to find out who placed an ad that's more or less negative against Tom Udall.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with drilling. And very misleading. And so I thought
here
I
it
would
is.
Look
well,
at
I'll give you the details. The American Energy, I'm looking at SourceWatch. The American Energy Alliance is an industry front group that was created in 1993 to defeat the BTU tax in the United States. Time magazine reported in 1993 that the National Manufacturers Association got together with the American, this is a quote, the verbatim quote from Time magazine, got together with the American Petroleum Institute, 1,600 large companies, small businesses, and farmers to form the American Energy Alliance, a group designed solely to defeat the BTU tax, which is basically a carbon tax. The coalition paid more than $1 million to Burston Marsteller, a public relations firm, to deploy nearly 45 staff members in 23 states during the past 2 months. Now, this is back in 93. Burston's goal was to drum up as much grassroots outrage about the BTU tax as possible and direct it in the swing Democrats, directed at swing Democrats on the Senate Finance Committee. In 2008, this group, the American Energy Alliance, sponsored radio advertisements in New Mexico attacking Congressman Tom Udall for his opposition to oil drilling. The New Mexico Independent noted that information on the group is hard to come by. There are no online Federal Energy Regulatory Commission filings, no Internal Revenue Service filings, and no way to contact the group.
Well, that's exactly what I found from M. Reichbach, New Mexico Independent, dated 23 July 2008. So, because what I'm interested in, does anybody know who anybody is on this?
Apparently not. Apparently not. I mean, if you're a private corporation, unless you're a publicly traded company, you don't have to disclose basically much of anything. Your tax returns are secret. You're granted. I wrote a book about this called Unequal Protection. You're granted the right of privacy in the United States. You're granted the Fifth Amendment right to not to incriminate yourself. The Fourth Amendment right of privacy. The First Amendment right of free speech. The 14th Amendment right against discrimination. All of these things, as a corporation, as a person. So apparently the AEA has figured out how to make use of this very well. And again, this will just be one of many as this election rolls along, Robert. This is just the beginning of it. But thanks for the heads up on that. Ron in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Ron.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Oh, it's still morning. How you doing?
another 16 minutes.
I've got a couple of things I want to bring up. One, I want to thank you for taking McCain to task. I'm a Vietnam vet, and those of us who remember McCain, we remember him as being a scumbag, point blank.
Yeah, my point, and what you're talking about is yesterday, I said I don't consider John McCain a war hero. I had been, up until yesterday, I had been taking the position that we should respect his service. That's the position that Obama has been taking. But the fact of the matter is that this guy, lost four planes and had one shot out from underneath him. He graduated at the bottom of his class. He had a reputation as a drunk and a womanizer. He screwed up over Vietnam and ignored a missile warning, got shot out of the sky, a bad eject. He within 4 days of his being taken captive, he was singing like a songbird. We should call him Songbird McCain. He made over 30 propaganda videos for the Vietnamese. Yes, he was offered early release. All of the prisoners were offered early release. That was the.
But he was told by the senior PO when they came home, he could come home. He's running around saying, "Well, I wanted to stay with my troops." He stayed there because he was not allowed. The senior PO there would not allow him out of there because his daddy was the admiral of the Navy who was responsible for bombing North Vietnam at that time. I was there. I was aboard the carrier Midway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, I'm not really impressed with him, and I'm so tired of the other liberal radio stations not doing their history checking.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people out there who call themselves, you know, they're blasting reporters and stuff like that, saying they're not journalists. But they're not doing their own work.
Yeah.
I heard it this morning, and it really just angers me that there's only maybe one or two of the liberal talk show hosts in America who are willing to stand up and tell it like it is, and you're one of them. I thank you very much, and I know there are other vets out there, and if they want to go to Vietnam Veterans Against John McCain, boy, would they get an enlightenment.
Is that the website?
VietnamVetsAgainstJohnMcCain.com, and let me tell you, remember David Hackworth?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hackworth said that half the medals he has on his chest he didn't earn. He's not even supposed to be wearing them.
Hmm.
So, you know, and this was before he died. So, you know, you can't really question him, but he put it in print.
Yeah. Vietnam Vets Against John McCain.com. Is that right?
Vietnam Veterans. Make sure you put veterans in there or it won't come up.
Okay. Vietnam Veterans
Against John McCain.com. And you'd be surprised. There's so much in there, even about the missing POWs and stuff.
Right. Oh, I know. He was a major problem with the POWs.
Yeah.
Ron, thanks a lot for the heads up. I got to go. 45 minutes past the hour.
An historic time for America. Live, on-site coverage of the Democratic National Convention on Air America and AirAmerica.com. Our time is now.
Just ain't stretching like it might have once before. Cause the good jobs are all gone, left you in some big box store. Between food and rent and medicine, seems the suit's frayed a little bit more. When the boss cut that last corner, they walk out of those doors. When the truckers hauling sweatshop stuff won't stop there anymore. When the folks won't cross your pickets cause their folks the same as yours. That is one big union.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Every week we do a segment where we pick up an advertiser with one of our local radio stations and give them a minute to tell about their product and a minute to tell about their experience advertising on Progressive Talk Radio, in the hopes that those of you who are listening who own businesses might think about, particularly local businesses, even small local businesses, might think about advertising on the radio station that you're listening to right now. Because I'm telling you, radio is the most cost-effective medium in all of advertising, and talk radio is one of the most effective forms, one of the most effective platforms for advertising. So we will do this little two-minute segment, and then we'll get back to your phone calls. Jacques Pugh is with us. He is the spokesperson for Progressive Tech in Seattle. Progressive Tech, TECH.com, is the website. And Jacques, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Thank you. You know, Progressive Tech is a Seattle-based, a locally owned company. And as you mentioned, you know, we are greatly concerned with the environment and the community, as well as our responsibility to others, because we believe that that's a hallmark of being a small business. Now, we fix computers. We build and support networks for individuals and small to medium-sized businesses. The company's origins are humble in that way, and we're growing in what we believe is pretty much the quintessential American business model. Truth, honesty, integrity. They're all hallmarks of how we conduct ourselves business-wise. We provide great value, superior service, and honest advice that really tends to educate our clients in computer technology, and we believe in doing what's cost-effective for them. So we always defer to what's right for them, even if it means, you know, a little less money for us. Our clients are pretty important to us because we just don't see their computers. We see them. They own the computers. We know how important it is, especially in this day and age where many people, progressives in particular, get a great deal of authentic and real news and information over the web. So in that sense, we endeavor to be a strong catalyst within both the business community, especially the small and medium-sized business community, because we believe it's the backbone of America's economy, and we believe in the strength of the progressive community, and we want to help to continue to be a part in enriching it and helping it move forward and helping people communicate and use those great tools of technology.
Jacques, you got a great product. I had lunch with, I think it was Martin Roth, one of your owners, and he and the other fellow with him, one of your techs, gave me some advice on dealing with a virus on my computer that was so spot on. The next day, I mean, it solved a problem that I had that was just wonderful. ProgressiveTech.com is the website. Tell us real quickly what happened when you started advertising on Talk 1090 in Seattle.
Oh, it's been great. Very effective. You know, Tom, we started advertising on your show exclusively because we appreciated your approach and your depth of knowledge. We have since expanded our partnership with AM 1090 here in Seattle, and it's been paying huge dividends. The AM 1090 staff, the sales, the programming, and the engineering folks, they're all stellar, and we couldn't ask for a better relationship. You remember their work at the forum was particularly indicative of how great they are. But I have to say that the clients that come to us from listening to AM 1090, they are the best people. They're often the people that we spend, you know, a lot of time having great conversations with, especially in this critical age that we find ourselves living in.
Yeah. Jacques, so, are you making money on the advertising, bottom
yes,
line?
Yes,
it's a good investment.
In fact,
Martin who I saw you guys Saturday night at the gig up there,
uh-huh,
and at the meet and greet beforehand, and I think it was Martin said to me one day you got five customers from your advertising on Talk 1090 in one day.
In one day, because the folks at AM 1090 allowed us to redesign our advertising campaign, and it worked out well. It's a win-win all the way around.
That's great. Jacques, I got to run, but thank you very much for being on with us, and thanks for advertising on Talk 1090 on Progressive Talk Radio. ProgressiveTech.com is the website.
Sure, Tom. Thank you.
Good talking with you, Jacques. Thank you very much. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ben in Los Angeles. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Tom. Thank you and your screener for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
Tom, I think the Republicans would rather go to war with Iran than admit that Eisenhower stole Iran's oil in the early 50s and install a Shah as dictator over the Iranian people.
Well, I think it's common knowledge, Ben.
Yeah, and in my opinion, to admit this is about the first step that we have to take to reestablish working relations with the Iranians. In closing,
yeah,
I'd like to point out one other thing. Doesn't the 12th Amendment state that the electors should choose the country's vice presidents? That's all.
Yes.
Thanks for your time, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yes, it does, but in the context of the election. It doesn't say that they should propose who the vice president should be. Ben, is this another Ben in Los Angeles?
No, this is Jim in Los Angeles.
Jim in Los Angeles.
Jim,
we just have 1 minute.
McCain.
I'm sorry.
I'm Johnny McCain's classmate, and I want you to stop Swift voting him. Okay? I love you. You've written 1,000 more books than I have, and you're a great guy, but stop Swift voting him. I made hundreds of carrier landings. How many did you make? Get off this kick about attacking his spine. You guys don't know what you're talking about. Let's just hit him on his positions and his votes. And stop the Swift voting, please.
Okay, Jim, I got your position. Thank you very much. I am personally concerned with the deification of the military. Our police officers put their lives on the line every day for us. Our firefighters put their lives on the line for us every day for us. We are not going out saying, oh, thank you for your service to every single cop that you see. It seems to me that as this country is becoming more militarized and more of a military state, there is this fetish with deifying anybody who's ever been in the military and not calling John McCain, for example, on things like making up his crust in the sand story. I'm sorry. I'm going to call him on it. We're wrapping up the show. Coming up tomorrow, Joseph Farah is going to be on along with Terry Jeffries, CNS News, and, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.